man pointed above them.
But, sir, the dish
can be replaced. There's nothing special about it. We simply need a big dish antenna to communicate with the kite. Moving the comps is easy. They hardly weigh a thing. A couple of 100 pounds.
Any ideas where, sir?
The Baron started to speak when he noticed an old slave shuffling past the electric fence.
We'll discuss this inside.
Returning to the throne room, the Baron directed his staff around a table piled with maps, some plastic, a few hand-drawn on deerskin, one or two made of yellow paper. Shifting the map of Tennessee to the bottom of the pile, he pulled another showing the east coast of pre-dark America. Corrections had been made to the coastline and land with a brown ink of some kind.
These are the other locations of big antennas.
He watched them lean in close to see.
Silas could have used any, but chose this one because it was the first dish he found.
And it was near a redoubt, but that was none of their business. Suddenly alert, Colette watched the Baron's face, sensing he was withholding important information, and wondered what it was that she had just missed.
Of all the possibilities, these 13 are our best bet.
A sergeant interrupted him.
My lord?
What?
Sir, I've been hunting over here in Georgia, and there's nothing there but desert and some canny muties. Little green bastard's got a taste for horse, and damn near got me. Ain't no dish, though, sir.
Colette reached for her blaster.
You dare to correct your baron?
Magnanimously, Sheffield raised a hand, stopping her.
Thank you, Sergeant. Fresh information is always useful. Any other corrections?
The staff officer studied the maps, and finally decided that one mistake was the only flaw.
Good. That saves us a lot of time.
Sheffield blacked out the side of Georgia Tech College.
Time we do not have to spare or waste. I'll send 2 squads to wreck the remaining 6. As soon as they find one, they come back, and I'll decide whether we go or wait for a better location.
Conversation stopped as a slave girl entered the room with a silver tray of sandwiches. Sheffield flipped over the top map, and the blue shirts waited in silence until she had returned to the kitchen.
Lieutenant Brandon?
Sir.
Take 10 men with you. It'll be crowded in the wag, but you're sure to lose some along the way.
Cold-hearted bastard.
Yes, my lord.
Sergeant Campbell, do the same. Load the wags with all the fuel and ammo needed, then take what food can be stored inside. You can always raid Ville's for more.
We're giving them the wags?
Yes, I am assigning them wags. My troops cut the time by half this way. It's a gamble, but one that I am willing to take.
As you say.
Rolling up the plastic map, Sheffield looked hard at the SecMen.
You'll each receive a copy of the map just before you leave. Concentrate on your mission, and don't worry about the other wag not coming back. I can monitor every word of conversation spoken inside them with the kite. Anybody goes rogue, and I'll melt the wag with the men inside.
Campbell spoke up.
So we can ask you for help, sir?
Clever bastard. Sheffield frowned.
Doesn't work like that. I can hear you, but you can't hear me. Amplifiers, you know, system feedback.
The Baron had no idea what the words meant. These were simply things he had heard Silas say once while trying to fix a cassette player. The men nodded in understanding, nudging the sergeant for asking a stoop question. Only Colette knew it was all a lie, but to the sec man, tech stuff was always accepted without question. She knew that most of the Blues didn't know how an engine worked, or even their own blasters. Electronics was magic as far as they were concerned.
Avoid the roads and use rivers whenever possible, and you'll make better speed. Also, less chance of hitting a roadblock and having to waste ammo on mercies or cold hearts.
Brandon smiled at her mistake.
River bed, you mean? Not in the actual water.
No, she's correct. Use the rivers. The wags are amphibious.
Awkwardly, the men shifted their stances, trying to pretend they understood the words.
The wags are waterproof. They can float. Chill anybody who gets in the way. Put the fear of the Blues into the bastards. Pave the way for our return. The first team will be designated Alpha. They'll check the sites in northern Tennessee, eastern Kentucky, and Pennsylvania. Beta team will bypass Georgia and wreck the middle of North Carolina, South Virginia, then upstate.
Lot of ground to cover.
Campbell walked his fingers across the paper, trying to guess the distances involved.
Yes, but there is a lot at stake.
Sheffield crossed his arms and smiled. Now was the time to give them the carrot.
The first team that finds what we need will be assigned as permanent guards for the new Gaudy House. No wall patrols for the rest of their lives.
The grim faces in the throne room brightened at the prospect, smiles abounding. It was a rich reward. Brandon hitched up his gun belt.
When can we go, sir? The sooner we leave, the sooner we come back with a new vill for you.
Caught unprepared, Campbell shot the officer a heat-filled glance, but said nothing. Damn ass-kisser.
Good man. You'll leave within the hour, and the slaves will start packing today. Once we have a goal, we leave immediately. This valley is dead.
About those two sites in Virginia.
Colette rubbed her nose thoughtfully. Spotted that, did she? Sheffield cleared his throat.
The first is near Green Coveville. Good walls, and that's about all we know. The other is just east of Front Royal. I'm very glad that Silas didn't melt the place, because it may just become our new base.
Front Royal? But, sir, they have wags, troops, an awful lot of our own AK-47 blasters, Grens, and Nathan Carter is known to be a chilling machine.
We can take them. They're just a bunch of farmers and whitehairs. Easy chilling.
Scowling, Colette shook her head.
Front Royal is an armored citadel that no amount of troops can take. Only a fool or a madman would even try.
So, what are we going to do if that's our best site? Melt them a little with the kite as a warning?
That would be a waste. I can do much worse to Cawdor and his brown shirts. Much worse.
Rise and shine, lover.
Ryan walked naked from the steaming shower. He grabbed a towel from a pile and started to dry himself. Christy grumbled from underneath the blankets.
I'll rise, but that's all. Oh, what time is it?
Afternoon. She cracked a smile.
Just getting up yourself, I see.
Ryan tossed aside the damp towel and began to pull on some clothes.
Second shower today for me. We spent most of the morning cleaning that damn ash out of the garage so we could work on the crossbows. Blasted shit gets up your nose and down your boots like it's alive.
And you didn't wake me? I looked that bad, eh?
With a shrug, Ryan started to button a shirt.
You were hit the worst by the kite. I needed some extra sack time, that's all. Now go wash. Lunch is ready.
Christy sat upright on the bed, the blankets tumbling to her waist. She yawned, stretching her arms wide.
More soup. We should dip the arrowheads in it.
As always, Ryan felt himself responding to her beauty, but shoved those thoughts aside. There was too much work to do. He buckled on his gun belt.
Too dangerous. It might rot the metal. Get moving.
Stumbling from the warm bed, the nude woman scratched herself as she padded across the barracks floor and into the shower. Minutes later, she emerged from the clouds of soapy steam, scrubbed pink, her hair cascading down her back. Ryan waited as she donned clothing, then they headed for the cafeteria. Lunch was the same as dinner. The companions forced down more of the hot gray soup and ate another generous helping of the cat food. It left a bad taste in their mouths that wouldn't go away, even with brushing or gargling. But it eased the pain in their bellies and put strength back in their hands. Good enough. Afterward, the companions spent the rest of the day finishing the crude weapons. Doc trimmed the dining room knives to notched arrowheads, Dean lathed broom and mop handles into wooden shafts, Mildred used her delicate touch with a blade to split pillow feathers into fletching, Christy used glue and thread to attach them, and Jack fixed the arrowheads into place with electrical tape salvaged from outlets and light switches. The arrows were ugly but balanced. That was all they could ask for. Ryan and J.B. did the heavy work. The big lathe cut table legs into stocks, and the long, flat metal strips from the beds became the cross-member pieces. The string for the weapons was the difficult part. Twine wouldn't take the tension. J.B. tried, and the 100-year-old ropes snapped every time. Mildred suggested hunting for a guitar or a piano. The metallic strings of the musical instruments would be perfect for the crossbows. But none was available. Ryan solved the problem by attacking the elevator with a hacksaw and removing the support cable. The main cable was a bundle of thin wires twisted together to form smaller cables, which were braided to make a thick one. It was incredibly strong, and as difficult as hell to get loose. The cable snapped free halfway through the operation, and shot into the upper levels like a whip.